I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz started his second term this week, but he continues in office in the midst of a shift in the political climate. A new Republican governor takes office next month in Annapolis. And Howard County, Harford County, and Anne Arundel County all have newly elected Republicans at the helm. The Republican Party also picked up another seat on the Baltimore County Council, which narrows the advantage for Democrats to 4-3. Kevin Kamenetz joins us in Studio A to talk about the state of the county, the state of the Democratic Party following the midterm elections. That's coming up next on Midday. First, the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday Friday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here again. Thank you so much for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Baltimore County Executive Kevin Kamenetz, now in his second term in Baltimore County, is our guest in this first hour of the show. We'll get to Kevin Kamenetz in just a moment. I just want to tell you what's coming up in the second hour today. It's Midday on Film with Christopher Llewellyn Reed and Linda DeLibro. Our Midday critics will be here in the second hour to talk about the films of 2014, since it's the December edition of Midday on Film, that's what we do. We take a look back at some of the notable films of the year, a look ahead to the films in the current cinema and coming up in the holiday season, and a little Oscar buzz. That's in the second hour of our show today. Also, Hiroya Sukamoto will be joining us. He was with us last year, a Japanese guitarist who's visiting Baltimore again, performing in Pikesville tomorrow night. He'll be in the studio with us in the second hour of our show today. Well, we all know the outcome of the November election. Democrats nationwide in the midterms did not do very well. Republicans did very well. And here in Maryland, Larry Hogan, a Republican, pulled off a stunning upset by defeating Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown to win the governor's race. Larry Hogan takes office next month. Republicans also came out on top in the county executive races in Howard County, Harford County, and Anne Arundel counties, ringing Baltimore City. And out there in Baltimore County is Democrat Kevin Kamenetz, who won a second term and took the oath of office for his second term this week. And he's visiting with us now in Studio A. Nice to have you back on the show, Kevin Kamenetz.
Thanks, Dan.
Also, I should note the county council. Republicans picked up a seat on the county council. The advantage there for Democrats is now 4-3. Also, very interesting outcome in Dundalk, typically a Democratic stronghold, where we saw Republicans sweep in both the county and state offices out there. The county council member now from Dundalk is Republican. So anyway, I guess I ought to ask you all about that, because this is my first time to talk to you since the election. And what did you make of it? What did you make of the shift nationwide in the midterms and here in the state?
Well, clearly across the country, there's Obama fatigue, and that's not unusual for an incumbent president in his sixth year. I think it's compounded in the state by what I'll call O'Malley fatigue. And again, it's a governor who served for 8 years. And, you know, similar results happen at the end of Governor Glendening, Governor Schaefer. You know, it's not an uncommon cycle in politics. And then on the east side of the county, I'll say it's probably more of what we call triple O fatigue. Obama, O'Malley, and Olszewski. And again, you know, you had a councilman who served for 16 years, and his son was rising from the House of Delegates to
the Senate. Both Democrats.
Yes. So, you know, the trends were there, and obviously, you know, the economy has not improved, and, you know, that hurts people, and people, therefore, are going to vote for change. And I think there's also, you know, there's an angst out there. Geez, what's happening across the country with the you know, Ferguson issues, but also what's happening across the world, you know, religious intolerance and, you know, warring countries and now Russia. You know, it's a sense of uncertainty out there. And, you know, when people are uncertain, they are scared. And when they're scared, they get angry. And when they get angry on election day, they vote out the incumbents.
When you say the economy is not improving, what do you sense in Baltimore County? I mean, we have some pretty good numbers today from the Labor Department on unemployment, on employment, and also on wages for the first time since last June. So when you say the economy's, I mean, a lot of people will agree with you. They feel that it's flat, even though it's things seem to be picking up in certain indicators.
Sure.
Like this one today.
The trend is going the right direction. The unemployment rate is dropping. It's also dropped in Baltimore County for the first time in many years. It is now below both the national and state levels, which is great for us.
Where do you think it is in the county? I mean, what numbers do you get for the county itself?
We're
below 6%.
You know, we just had a number, and I can't recall.
but you recall that it was better than the
state number.
I
looked at the
average. Better than the
national. Where is the national now?
We're like 6.3 or something like that, or even below 6.
So we were 5.8. Yeah, 5.8.
5.8.
We
okay.
Yeah. So, I think the biggest point you just made was wage stagnation. And that's where we haven't really seen improvement. So look, even Baltimore County employees, you know, they've gone without pay raises for years, without COLAs for years, and we've also asked them to contribute more to their health care and to their retirement system. Now I'm pleased that we, in this current budget, just this month, in fact, we gave them a 3% bonus, and next year we're going to give them a COLA, but. They've gone without for a long time, so I can imagine what's also going on with in the private sector. So, that's why I think the economy is still flat is the best word. You're right.
Just for the record, 321,000 new jobs in November, according to the Labor Department. That's out today, and the unemployment rate remains at about 5.8%. You think it's about that in Baltimore County?
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, we're really bullish on where we are going to be in terms of that, in terms of job creation. I mean, we're being clever in our redevelopment efforts. For example, downtown Towson, we're turning into a true county seat that will have great opportunities for high-rise living for empty nesters and young professionals, as well as offering people opportunities to shop and dine, go to first-class movie theaters. But Sparrows Point is something that's interesting. You know, in its heyday, Sparrows Point, Bethlehem Steel, employed 30,000 people, and that's a significant number. I mean, I've toured the place now, and it's 3,000 acres. It's just an incredible city. But when RG Steel closed, there were just 2,000 employees. So our goal, and we've been focused on this for the past 4 years, is to turn Sparrows. I mean, we recognize steelmaking's dead, and we respect and honor our venerable history, but we need the job creation engine there for the next generation. And we're very excited about the game plan in terms of getting the port there and getting distribution logistics. It's a remarkable piece of land, unlike anywhere else on the East Coast. 3,000 acres of industrially zoned land that has deep water port access, plus access to two interstate highways and two rail lines.
And there's already some capital in place for the environmental cleanup, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. First of all, we're delighted with the current ownership group, and we've been meeting regularly with state and port officials over the past 2 years to plot out a game plan. I set up a task force several years ago. The Sparrows Point Partnership, they came out with a blueprint of what we think would make sense utilizing those characteristics. And we couldn't get the original ownership group to buy into it. Quite frankly, they were interested in making the most money they could as opposed to seeking the highest and best use of the land. We now have an ownership group that recognizes the latter characteristic and also has local ties, so they have a sense of the history of the area and the impact that it has on families.
I want to talk more about Sparrows Point. Also, you mentioned Towson redevelopment. I want to talk to you about Larry Hogan, the new governor, and the Red Line. Those are the things that are on my agenda here. This is something I was struck by in your inaugural speech on Monday. Baltimore County must be a place where people of diverse backgrounds and beliefs feel comfortable living and working together. We must nurture an environment where discourse is passionate but always civil and constructive. You use the word inclusion, you use the word diversity, you refer to different people's differences in class, religion, color, ethnicity. So let's talk about that a little bit. I wonder, you know, what was on your mind as you were putting together your inaugural speech this year? Maybe what's on your mind has been on the mind of many people, and that is Ferguson and what followed there. And then this week, a grand jury decision up in Staten Island regarding Mr. Garner and the New York City case. And we had protests reach Baltimore last night during the monumental lighting. So it's very much on people's minds where we are in terms of race relations and relations between the police and the public. So I just wonder, what were you thinking when you made these remarks in your inaugural?
Well, how could it not be on anyone's mind right now? And we talked about it before, the national unrest that I think takes place with race relations. But, you know, I mentioned before, in terms of religious intolerance all around the world and the wars that are being fought over religion, it's scary, isn't it? When I was elected 4 years ago, I made a concerted effort to recognize the fact that in order for a very diverse county to have confidence in the decisions that their government makes, it has to reflect that diversity. And it's not just a token, oh, I need a token race here or a female here. It's really bringing together diverse viewpoints to consider things from a different perspective. And we really worked hard. I mean, when I took over, we had, let's start with the county. I mean, the county has changed significantly. We're a very large county. We're larger in population than Baltimore City, Washington, D.C., Boston, Atlanta. We're larger in population than four states.
Is it 800,000?
832,000.
32,000, wow.
And can you name the four states?
Are smaller than Baltimore County? Rhode Island?
No.
Rhode Island is not one of them?
No.
Okay. Wyoming's one of them?
Yes.
Okay. I'll get to the other three in a minute.
That'll be the challenge at the end here.
I don't want to lose my train.
The idea, though, we're an extremely large jurisdiction, but also one that's diverse. So our minority or our non-white population now is 32%. We thought, you know, we need to make sure that we are reflecting that diversity in decision with decision makers. So now department heads, when I took office, 22% were African-American. Now it's 40%. 11% were female. Now it's 27%. And again, it's not to have tokens there, but it's to make sure that we're considering all viewpoints when making decisions. You know, we're raised with certain biases and values. Others see things in a different way because they were raised differently. And it's important to have that. But we especially made a concerted effort to diversify our police and fire departments. And we've had recruit classes over the last 4 years that approach 40% non-white male. It helps. I mean, I just went to a promotion today, so there were 10 officers who were being promoted, and, you know, several of them were female, several of them were African Americans. You know, that's important because the Ferguson occurred. First of all, you can't compare us to Ferguson because we have a very experienced and well-trained police force, and we're a large force. We're 1,900 sworn officers. But they're also trained to deal with a diverse population in a respectful and cooperative manner. When police officers walk down the streets in Baltimore County, the residents wave back and say hi. And that's built over this developing trust that's important. But it doesn't mean we should ignore it. We have to make sure, again, you just have a little more confidence when decisions are made that the people reflect the diversity of the communities that we serve.
Kevin Kamenetz is our guest in this hour of midday, the Baltimore County Executive, now in his second term. We'll take our first break here and invite phone calls with questions for the County Executive, 410-662-8780. That's how you reach us on midday. You can also send an email with a question to midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. All right, set the record straight here. In October, Baltimore County's unemployment rate fell to 5.6%. So if that held up through November, then it is lower than the national rate, lower than the statewide rate. Baltimore County has a population now, Kevin Kamenetz, our guest, tells me, of 832,000, making it larger than four of the states.
And you've gotten two so far. Well, I gave you the third.
You didn't have to say that. Wyoming, North Dakota I got, and then I said Rhode Island. You said no, but you're close. And then I said Maine. Then I said New Hampshire. Okay, Vermont, I forgot. So there's another one. There's another one that's smaller than Baltimore County. The Baltimore County executive is our guest in this hour of the show. If you know the fourth state, you can call in. I'd give you a prize, except we don't have one. 410-662-8780. We was talking about diversity in Baltimore County. I have a question to follow up on that. Affordable housing. This issue sort of blew up in Rosedale last year at this time. You might remember. I'm sure you remember. November last year in Rosedale, we talked about it on the air, wrote a column about it. There was a proposal for housing that would be affordable to people who made something like 60% of the county's average household income, median income, right? And that went away. The county council member from that district opposed it. There was some community opposition to the development that was going to be put in place by a nonprofit. That's what I remember. Anyway, it raised this whole issue of affordable housing in Baltimore County. It's a problem everywhere. It's a problem in Baltimore City, but also Baltimore County, which has no public housing. It has some subsidized housing, but not public housing. So, yeah, I mean, when you talk about diversity, diversity in housing, for instance. So do you have any ideas along those lines?
Well, let me clarify. First of all, we have increasing numbers of poor people living in Baltimore County, and we are actively engaged in methodologies to serve that population. And one of them is housing. Baltimore County does not own public housing units. We never have. We have our landlords, our private landlords, are authorized to accept Section 8 vouchers that we administer through the federal government. But that's up to the landlord of whether they choose to accept it. But then we inspect the facilities and provide the facilitation of those for eligible households. The Rosedale project was actually a great one because it allowed rent to own. So you were
encouraging
people to become homeowners, and that's what we want.
Yeah.
So what we've tried to do is recognize that there is a need for what is called affordable housing. Now, we have a lot of affordable housing of existing stock that, you know, the county is a very mature county. So we have housing stock that's 50, 60 years old, all, you know, mostly inside the Beltway. But people don't necessarily want to live in those neighborhoods. So it's really having affordable housing in neighborhoods where people want to live. But the response that the community sometimes give is disappointing because it's a knee-jerk response without really thinking through who these people are. We have increasing numbers of homeless in Baltimore County. Well, that's not the bum on the corner, you know, panhandling. It's really the person you went to elementary school with who fell, you know, into a cycle of unemployment or, you know, may have some personal issues. And, you know, all of a sudden they're without a home. We have school children. We have a large number of school children in Baltimore County who are homeless at any given moment.
Shouldn't the county take some leadership on this then? I mean,
well, we are. We've set aside.
The county council voted 6-0 against that proposal, right? They deferred to Kathy Bevins, the county council.
Correct,
woman, right?
Correct. Well, what happened was the resolution involved funding that came from the administration, but the council has the authority to accept or reject funding, so that's what they did. We have set aside economic development fund to help subsidize the construction of affordable housing. So that's one of our initiatives that we just put in place over the last year. And again, you know, we want decent housing product. I mean, that's really what we're talking about.
Kevin Kamenetz, the Baltimore County Executive, our guest for the full hour, and we'll take phone calls. 410-662-8780. We'll start with Casey, who's actually calling from Baltimore City. Casey, welcome to Midday.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Mr. Kamenetz, I just wanted to tell you I've been following you for a number of years now, and I think you do a phenomenal job in Baltimore County. I mean, I love the simple fact that you're more proactive rather than reactive in actually governing Baltimore County, and it shows just from the simple fact from what you're doing with Sparrow's Point. I've looked at a number of businesses in Baltimore County, you know, and I think you're doing a phenomenal job, and my hat's off to you, and that's all I wanted to really say.
Well, thanks, Uncle Casey. I appreciate you calling. I'm teasing.
Cousin Casey.
Yeah. Thank you. That was really nice of you, Casey.
Let's go back to Sparrow's Point for a minute. I think this is a really interesting project. You already laid out some of it there. In place is Redwood Capital, right? Redwood Capital has agreed to multi-million-dollar environmental cleanup, Deepwater Port. It augments what's already in place in the Port of Baltimore there. So what's the time frame for things? If you could look ahead, say, the next 4 years, your term, and then beyond that, what do you see happening down there in steps?
The first stage right now, first of all, what we've done in laying the groundwork of getting the port interested in the site has been ongoing for the past several years, and the fact that they agree that that's a great expansion opportunity.
You mean
for
the
them.
Port of Baltimore, the Port Administration?
Port of Baltimore. Yes. Port of, oh, sure. Okay. I mean, think about it. What I did was I thought, well, who is the greatest economic engine right now in the state? And it's the Port of Baltimore. And I thought, well, wow, you know, we're such a logical expansion area for them, and to get them interested. And then it started saying, okay. What about the cleanup responsibilities and what contamination does exist there, and making sure we had an entity that would be responsible for any cleanup? In terms of stages, the cleanup can start on the cleanup. Most of it is on the Cove Point area, and that's the most contaminated. That's only a small portion of it. Mm-hmm. So, there's a turning basin area that the port could take over immediately and get 1,000 jobs. There's the one area that they would use for storage of dredge material that will help the inner harbor or the Port of Baltimore Harbor, and then eventually become a new berth will take 10 years. But there are other opportunities for logistics distribution where we can get hundreds of jobs in place in the next year. So I'm very bullish on this, and, you know, and again, a lot of it, you know, may not come to, you know, be fully built in my term, my remaining 4 years, but it'll be there for the next generation.
Let's switch to Towson just to get an update on what's going on with redevelopment in Towson, where we are and what's online.
Well, we have a very stable tax rate here. We haven't raised property tax rate in 26 years. We haven't raised the income tax rate in 22 years. And we have that AAA bond rating from all three rating agencies. In order to maintain that stable tax rate, you have to expand your tax base. So we think that a logical area is downtown Towson. It's inside the Beltway. It's the county seat. It's home to two colleges and three hospitals. Wow, what a 45,000 people live in Towson, but 46,000 people work in Towson. And we thought, you know, why not create an area that has opportunities, high-rise opportunities for young professionals and empty nesters? The key to the attraction was creating a nightlife there. You have to have a reason to want to live there. So 3.5 years ago, there was a project, Towson Square, and it was in limbo, and I met with David Cordish. I said, all right, what do we need to do to get this thing going?
And he said a casino. No,
I'm kidding. So we sat down, and he said, I think I can get a first-rate movie theater there and then surrounded with restaurants. I said, well, I need to understand what type of theater, because we had a theater that wasn't first-rate.
In Towson Commons?
Yes. And I said, restaurants, I said, they have to be of unique character, restaurants that don't exist either in the region or the state. He says, all right. We built a garage to facilitate the parking. Cinemark Theater that opened this summer is Cinemark is one of the world's largest operators of movie theaters. The Towson Cinemark is now their flagship store of any in their chain. And it's magnificent. Have you been there yet?
Yeah, it's great.
It really, I mean, it just walking in and seeing the grand staircase. And did you notice that this movie theater has windows?
Yeah.
And a huge view. Mm-hmm. And you know, the floor-to-ceiling screens. And, you know, it really is, you know, an experience. And now the restaurants are starting to open up. So Jill and I had lunch yesterday at Nando's Peri Peri. And, you know, I liked it because it was spicy. She didn't. And then I said, well, here's on the border. We walked over there, and she said, yes, I would have liked that better. Of course, I made the wrong decision. But
you know, I just mentioned Towson Commons, where the other movie theater had been. And that's
We got a new...
What's going on there?
Got a new ownership group in there, and they have now LA Fitness is where the movie theaters used to be. And LA Fitness, this is their flagship store now. It has all the bells and whistles that none of the others have. And the new ownership group has, you know, we worked with them. They're putting a new facade on, and they have a lot of spaces that we hope will turn back into restaurants. But I also want to tell you, the restaurants on York Road, the traditional restaurants that have been there for a long time, they've upped their game. So the Green Turtle, rather than fearing competition, embraces it and says, hey, that movie theater is going to have a million visitors a year. We're going to get some of that spinoff. So, you know, we supported a loan to help them build a rooftop deck. That rooftop deck, you go up there, you feel like you're in Ocean City. It's really a nice, different feel. The Wrecker Theater operators, they've upped their game with the Towson Tavern. Totally, they're continuing investing and fixing it up. So that's all working out well. But the centerpiece of downtown Towson will be the Towson Row Project, which is a $300 million a mixed-use facility that will have office, retail, and residential. And they recently announced that Whole Foods will be locating there.
Did you locate that for people? Geographically, I mean, where in Towson is that?
All of this is, when we say downtown Towson, we mean from the Towson Town Mall to the Towson Library.
Okay. All in there. This is where the row is going to be.
Towson Row will be across the street from Towson Library on the other side of York Road. But it'll take all the blocks of Susquehanna and Chesapeake.
Now I'm going to switch over to the west side and ask you about the Red Line and Larry Hogan. Larry Hogan's a new governor. One of the things he said is he's not so sure about the Red Line, which is a $2.9 billion right now project for a light rail system to go from the west side of Baltimore County, depending how you're looking at it, to Bayview in Baltimore City. So you're sort of lukewarm. You've said you're lukewarm to this idea. Explain, why are you lukewarm about the Red Line?
Well, I'm concerned about the cost. I mean, that's, you know, my basic obligation here is, how do we fund things without raising taxes?
It's not all on the county. It would be partly on the county.
It has never been on the county.
Right. It's federal money. Right?
No. I want you to think about it. In the 10-year planning of the Red Line, there was never a conversation that the county or the city would participate. And in fact, in all of the construction that's taken place, both in Montgomery County and in Baltimore County, and the related line there through the city and Anne Arundel, the counties have never been obligated to contribute. It's always federal and state money. So at the very last minute, they've come to us. And when I say last minute, I mean a year and a half ago, I was approached to say, we're going to want a county contribution. And I said, well, what are you talking about? Well, last year I was told, we want $50 million. That wasn't even last year. That was the beginning of this year. I said, well, what do you mean you want $50 million? We've made a concentrated effort to focus on school construction, and we have devoted all of our capital dollars toward a $1.1 billion Schools for a Future program that's going to eliminate all current and projected overcrowding. That's our priority. Well, you're now going to have to do this. So we balked at it because of the expense.
I have a question. Before that came up, I understand the issue, but were you lukewarm to the Red Line before this, or only when
I was like everyone else. I was like everyone else. We rolled our eyes and let the so-called experts figure this out. Do I think that it was the best route? Probably not. But I didn't have any skin in the game, so it wasn't my job to sit there and get involved.
Why don't you get skin in the game, though? Why not embrace it?
Well, skin means... Well, no. Let me talk conceptually. We all support the concepts of mass transit. Who doesn't? Of course, you want to get from point A to point B without the use of an automobile. Of course, I support that. And do we want a stop at Social Security and CMS? Absolutely. That's important to us in the county. Social Security is the county's largest employer. So we want what makes Social Security happy. And we did get involved in some of the design work for on their behalf and negotiated some improvements that they wanted on behalf of our major employer. But, you know, do I think it's the most efficient methodology? Well, now that I do have skin in the game, probably not. I mean, I know Ben Rosenberg, the lawyer, who lives in Canton.
We had him as a guest here.
Yeah, I mean, he's got an alternative that I thought makes sense.
Which is what?
Well, he wants to continue the existing heavy rail
line
from Hopkins Hospital to Bayview, and he suggests doing a spur line from perhaps Lexington Market out to Social Security.
And you think that that would be cheaper than a new light rail?
Well, he suggests that. Now, if the other factor besides cost for Baltimore County is the recognition that the construction of the Red Line will usurp all future transportation project money. I mean, they're lying if they say otherwise, because I've seen their budget projections.
Do you mean public transportation or do you mean roads?
Roads.
Roads as well.
You want improvements to the Baltimore Beltway? Well, there aren't going to be many new projects initiated. You want restoration of county used highway user funds? Not happening.
So you're saying if the state gets the federal money for the Red Line, also the Purple Line, which is in play too, is several more billion dollars, that for the foreseeable future
there won't be any new projects.
Any new federal money for projects
state
money?
It has nothing to do with federal.
You're talking about state.
First
and
of all,
county.
The federal used to pay 80%. They're not even talking about that
kind
of dollar amount anymore.
I just want to clear up what you're saying, though. When you're saying it would
not
suck
federal,
all the air
state,
out of the room.
State projects.
There'd be no state money available for those projects. That's what you're saying.
For new projects, yes. Okay, do we want an interstate, an additional interstate exit on 795 at Dolefield Boulevard? State can't fund that. We've already built the connecting roads on Dolefield. The traffic warrants it, but they don't have the money to do it.
So if Larry Hogan calls you into his office, Kevin Kamenetz, and says, look, I'm going to pull the plug on the Red Line here. I got at least four years in office, and it's not going to happen during my time. Would you agree to that? Would you support
him? I'm not a decision maker on that.
But you can make public statements about it. You can let people know how you feel about it.
I think if he comes and says, you know, I'd like to examine alternative methods that could be less expensive. Before the Red Line was picked, there was a conversation under, the governor before the current governor to use a rapid lane. And I thought, he called it rapid bus. I thought, well, I don't get that. No one's riding buses.
A separate road,
but what it
really
is
for a bus,
yeah,
right?
Then I investigated
elevated road?
Yeah, it's an elevated, it's just like a subway line, and the bus isn't a bus. It looks like a subway train, but it's cheaper to build and to operate. So if it looks like a subway, people are going to ride it as a subway and utilize it. I thought, okay, that's worthy of conversation. If you can build that for a third of the cost, that's worth having a conversation. I think the biggest criticism I have about the current Red Line is it doesn't solve the hub issues. The Purple Line probably makes sense because they have a great system there and it feeds into the great system in Washington, D.C. We don't have that in Baltimore County. We've got, the one rail line, then we got the light rail that doesn't really touch the other one, and now you're going to have a third line that doesn't touch the other two. Well, that's not a true system.
Wouldn't the Red Line cross the current light rail line at some point?
No.
It must cross it somewhere.
No.
Because it goes up Howard Street. No?
No.
I got to look at the map
again. There's no overlap of any existing rail line. What they propose is they're going to bore through downtown Baltimore
right.
and build a parallel tunnel to the one at Charles Street, and then you're going to have to walk 1,000 yards, a city block, to go
from one to the other.
But yeah. they haven't funded the tunnel. That's not included, the connection. That's not included in their current costs. So, you know, these are conversations to have. If the governor-elect recognizes that we can't afford it, there might be a better way of doing it, I'm not opposed to that conversation.
Kevin, we'll take another break here. Kevin Kamenetz is the Baltimore County Executive. He just stepped into his second term of office. You're welcome to call with a question. Listeners in Baltimore County can reach us at 410-662-8780 or from anywhere in the state. Actually, we have a toll-free number that's good from anywhere in Maryland, 866-661-9309. Our midday email address, midday@wypr.org. All right, Kevin Kamenetz, this is a question from one of your constituents. It's a little complicated subject. It has to do with the Baltimore City's water system, which Baltimore County uses, right?
Yes.
The installation of new water meters. And it was recommended by the city. We received a letter at our home. Other homeowners in Baltimore City received a letter suggesting that we might want to buy insurance because while the water meter installation takes place, if there's a problem with the pipe that goes from the city's mains to your house, you're responsible for that. So you might want to purchase insurance in case anything goes wrong. And you said for county homeowners, you recommended not doing this, eschewing this extra insurance. Do you want to explain that for us a little bit?
Yeah, the city made a decision that it thought that there was a risk, there was a substantial risk that was going to be involved in by installing these new meters, that somehow there would be a surge of water pressure, and as a result, older pipes would have greater susceptibility to breaking. And it is correct that the city maintains from the supply to the little main in your sidewalk, and the homeowner is responsible from the sidewalk to the house. So they solicited a firm who offered a fixed price, what they considered to be a reasonable rate. But in exchange, they could market using the city's auspices. So we separately thought for our county residents, you know, I talked to my public works guys, and I said, is this for real? I mean, what are we going to have this kind of problem? Said our opinion was maybe our pipes aren't as old, that it was not a substantial risk. So what we said, and I got a letter as well from these insurance companies, and it struck me as a scam. I got it in my house. I'm thinking, what is this? You know,
the one
trying to scare me.
The one we received in the city
had a city
seal
endorsed.
On
yes.
it. Yeah, from Rudy Chow, the DPW
right.
director.
Yeah, well, that was part of their marketing agreement. So, so we decided, you know what? In the event that there is a breakage, we will finance it for the homeowner, just like we will finance an alley repaving or a sidewalk repaving. We put it on the property tax bill, and you pay us over 20 years at a negligible rate of interest. So that's what we decided we were going to do with this, 4% interest that they'll pay.
Okay.
So,
and you're sticking with
or
that.
Or over 40. It's 40 years. No.
40 years.
40 years. That's what it was.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't even 4% interest. It was 40
okay.
years. So, and if there was that occasion, we would help them pay for it over 40 years on their tax bill. We haven't had one incident yet, but you know, they just started with the meters.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that. Here's another comment or question from our phone lines. Here's Eric in Towson. Eric, you're on with Kevin Kamenetz, your county executive. Go right ahead. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm calling about concerns that I have about the Department of Permits and Inspections. I had an addition built a couple of years ago, and it passed all the inspections. And then I noticed some problems. I hired my own engineer. And we found numerous, numerous serious code violations in the project. And the county inspectors resisted citing the contractor, in fact, denied that the code violations even existed. I don't think they really even understand code violations in many respects. And so it was a serious problem for me, and still is a serious problem for me and my family. I think the problem is lack of training for the inspectors. I don't think they really, in many cases, understand building codes. They denied what my building engineer had said were the codes, and they refused to cite the contractor even after the violations were found. And at the same time, there are numerous cutbacks going on, and the inspectors say, well, we're too busy. We've had four guys laid off. They're not being replaced. And this is a serious health and safety issue that I don't think is being taken seriously by Mr. Javelin. In fact, in my case, Mr. Javelin said that there were no code violations, but ultimately a judge found dozens and dozens of code violations. Right. Even after the judge found the violations, Mr. Javelin said there were no violations.
Okay. Eric, here's the issue.
He's referring, by the way, to Arnold Javelin, who is your county
He's director
planning?
Of permits. Approvals and inspections. Right. Eric, you're mixing the function of what this code inspector is. First of all, there are no cutbacks. In fact, we have just increased the number of code inspectors that we are having, and we've also automated the code enforcement process where we're using technology and people can make complaints by the internet and receive real-time tracking of what's going on with their issue. But when you did an addition, that's something different. That's when we have an inspector come out for basic minimum standards to make sure that a roof doesn't collapse or the foundation is improper, that someone's not going to get electrocuted when they plug something in. That's their job. They are not there to assure quality performance by your contractor. They are only there to ensure that basic minimum standards are kept. Your issue has nothing to do with the county. We're not there to help make sure that you get a quality job. Your issue is with your contractor, and when you say there are violations, that means that there are standards that were not met to the minimum level of expectations. That's the distinction here.
There's another call. James in Cockeysville, you're on with Kevin Kamenetz, too. Go right ahead. Hi.
Kevin.
Hello.
Hello, Kevin. Can you spell graft?
All right. All right. We'll see you later, James. The red line crosses the current light rail at Howard Street, and the distance between the surface light rail and the underground red line station is less than 300 feet. This is an email from Klaus Philipson, Baltimore architect, who's a contributor to Midday.
I know Klaus.
Yeah.
It's not a station.
Okay. What's not a station, Kevin? What do you mean? It's a red line station. You mean it's not a stop? And the proposed red line, he says, there's a station is less than 300 feet from the surface light rail.
Okay.
Okay. That, he says the red
from
line
the light rail.
Yeah.
How about the from the heavy rail?
Well, he says the red line connects to the metro at Charles Center with a surface city block in between. That's the one you're referring to. Okay.
Yes, that's what I said.
These distances between connecting transit modes are common in many cities. The red line also connects to the MARC station at West Baltimore and at Bayview. So he just wanted to point that out anyway. So I understand your concerns about it are mostly financial.
Well, Bayview's not a stop, so I don't even know what he's talking about. Oh, at is MARC. Okay.
The MARC station.
Right, right.
At the Bayview where it finishes.
Right.
There'll be a MARC connection there.
Correct.
So your main concern is the cost of it. You didn't expect the county to have any have a bill from this.
We didn't budget for it. Okay. We budget years in advance, you know.
What do you know about Larry Hogan, and have you met him?
Not much, and no.
You haven't met him. Do you? I guess you expect to meet him.
Yeah, I. You know, I mean, we've crossed paths, so to speak. But
well, what do you expect is going to happen here? What are you expecting to hear from the new governor when he takes office about his plans for, you know, governance in Maryland, the state budget?
Well, what I expect is that he's going to recognize he got 60% of the vote in Baltimore County, and he better deliver for Baltimore County if he wants to get that again. You know,
what are you going to ask him for?
I want school construction money, and I want transportation funding. I mean, those are our needs from the state. It's as simple as that. And more importantly, I don't want him to balance his budget on our backs. So when he talks about cutting fees and even the rain tax he's going to cut out, well, all he's saying is, counties, you pay for these obligations out of your own budget. Well, that's not helping us. That's passing the buck.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not responsible.
And as far as the stormwater fee goes, you may reference it. as the rain tax, if you wish. It's okay. The stormwater fees.
It's like Obamacare. As soon as he owned it, it became an acceptable term.
Stormwater fee in Baltimore County is in place. It's already in place.
Well, how much time do we have to start this conversation?
Why, you don't want to talk about it?
I can. It's just going to take a little while to talk about.
Fee is in place. People are paying the fee or not?
Yeah, here's what's happened.
Yeah, we have 5 minutes
all
left.
All right. That's
a lot of time in radio.
Give me a second then. Because people don't know all the facts on this, and I'd like to educate as many people as possible as to what I understand.
I'm all for it.
The Chesapeake Bay Foundation sued the federal EPA for enforcement of the 1972 Clean Water Act. And the EPA agreed and told the state of Maryland, you now have to comply. And the court passed an order that required Maryland to meet certain standards. And the state then said to the counties, okay, this is now your responsibility to these 10 jurisdictions. We said, well, that's not our obligation. That's a state obligation. How are we going to pay for it? They said, we'll raise taxes. I said, well, we're not raising taxes. So they said, okay, the General Assembly passed a law mandating that we raise taxes.
The 10 largest jurisdictions.
10 jurisdictions,
Maryland.
Yes. Right. So we said, okay, Baltimore County, you know, we're great stewards of the environment. 2/3 of our land is rural in nature, and citizens are on well and septic. And we have 200 miles of waterfront. So we take the environmental protection seriously, and we said, okay, we're going to comply with the obligations you gave us to comply with, to meet the standards within a 10-year time frame. So we estimated what the cost of these improvements are, and these are things that people like. Tree planting, stream restoration, street sweepers. You know, who's not in favor of any of those things? Well, that's what the money's going for. So we identified $30 million worth of projects each year that we will need to implement in order to meet this federal mandate of goals. And we decided $10 million of that $30 will absorb within our existing budget. And then we raised $20 million by the fee. We also made a concerted effort to ensure that residents weren't overly burdened. So you pay for a single family $39. For a townhouse, you pay $24 annually. That's it. But we put the financial burden more heavily on the commercial side. And we did so because, frankly, they're the biggest contributors to runoff. If you think about these large, older shopping centers that are built to maintain standards for Christmas and Black Friday shopping, but are, you know, somewhat empty other times of the year, there's a lot of runoff that carries with it, that go into our streams, the oil and tar and dirt and so forth. So, you know, we measure the amount of impervious area and charge them on that. But if they make improvements, then they get credits back. So that's what this is all about. So if the state says, well, you no longer have to charge, you know, the residents or the businesses, well, they're not relieving us of the obligation. So that means we'll have to come up with another $20 million to comply. And I got to tell you, that means there's $20 million a year that we won't be able to build schools or build roads or bridges or things like that. I think the responsible conversation should be for the governor-elect to go back to the EPA and renegotiate the consent decree to buy us more time. I mean, that is solving a problem. You know, and also defining what impervious is so we have consistent regulations throughout. But everyone wants a cleaner bay.
It was excellent in 5 minutes, and you did very well. Thank you very much. Actually, you did it in 4 minutes. So thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you.
Yeah, Kevin Kamen is Baltimore County Executive. He'll come back and visit us again. He's now in his second term as County Executive. Thank you very much for being here.
Hey, Dan, it's always a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Please enjoy some lunch, too. It's Friday lunch provided by Joe's Squared Pizza. So it's right outside our studios, and you and Don Moeller can have a little bit of that.
We had it beforehand. Yeah, it was delicious.
It's very good, isn't it?
Delicious.
Joe's Squared is located at 133 West North Avenue if you want to pick up some more on your
way
home.
I rode by it over on the way here. Got to give them a shout out.
It's right
it
here
in
the Station North neighborhood. Also at Inner Harbor at Power Plant Live. So go down and see David Cordish, get a slice of pizza. And you can find them on the web at joesquared.com. All right, folks, that's our first hour of Midday Friday. Please stay tuned for the news from NPR. And then we'll have Midday on Film with Chris and Linda.